Salutations, sports nerds. It's time for another episode of War on Hot Takes, presented by Capital News Service. I am Adam Zelanka, and with me, as always, is my partner in crime, Dylan Sin. And we have got a packed show for you, as we do every week. But before we take off, we want you to open up a new tab there on your computer, go to twitter.com, and follow us at War on Hot Takes. And you can find us on cnsmaryland.org and SoundCloud and Stitcher. So, Dylan, what is on tap for us this week?
Well, Adam, we've got to return to baseball once again. Dusty Baker is out of Washington, won't return as the Nationals manager. We'll analyze that. Then we'll discuss the Wizards and what went wrong in their first loss of the season after starting 3-0. Finally, we'll talk NFL action. Where is Washington now in the NFC playoff hunt? And the question on everyone's lips, is Joe Flacco an awful quarterback?
But first, we talked last week, we thought it was going to be the end of baseball for this podcast, at least for a while, and we said we would only talk about it again if something very extraordinary happened, and well, it turns out that this week, one of the biggest stories in Washington and Baltimore sports was a baseball-related story. The Nationals fired manager Dusty Baker after just two seasons in which, incidentally, the Nationals won 192 combined games, that is more than any other two-year stretch in not just Nationals history, but in Montreal Expos history as well. So it was the most successful by regular season victories two-year stretch in franchise history, and after it, Baker, his contract was not renewed. Adam, why did they do this?
Well, Dusty Baker isn't even sure why they did this, Dylan. And before we go any further, all I gotta say is, can I get an organ drop? That's better. All right, really getting our money's worth out of this free sound effect. Dusty Baker also doesn't know why he was let go, fired. Like you said, his contract's not renewed, gets six in one hand, half dozen in the other. That's essentially what it is.
He's absolutely fired.
He's gone. Mm-hmm. And what he told USA Today was that he was stunned. It took the club 10 days to get back to him with a decision. He was surprised and he was disappointed. He sort of felt like, what else can I do with the talent I've got here? Now, the case for him getting fired is, of course, you know, you can win 192 regular season games in two seasons, and that's fantastic. His record in the postseason of those two seasons, 4-6.
Right.
And when you've got the talented club you've got in Washington, all across the roster, superstars, pitchers, superstar hitters, and there's limited competition at the top of the National League, just basically the Dodgers and Cubs. I don't blame the front office for expecting a series win, you know, just the NLDS, get through that far. It's not enough to win the NL East because the NL East was the worst division in baseball this year. Would you agree with that, or am I just...
I would absolutely agree with that. There was several of the NL East teams are a couple of years away. The Mets were supposed to be the major competition, but their pitching staff fell apart with injuries.
Yeah.
And this is not just a recent issue for Dusty Baker-managed teams. He has historically struggled in the playoffs. He led the Giants to the World Series in 2002. He led the Cubs to one win from the World Series, the Steve Bartman game, in 2003. But other than that, he has really had some issues with his teams in the playoffs.
According to ESPN Stats and Info, Dusty Baker had, or currently has, the worst postseason record for all managers who have managed at least 30 games in the postseason. It's a winning percentage of .418. And yet, this is a guy who's been around forever. He was, at the time of his firing, the second most experienced manager among the current 30 Major League teams. Only Bruce Bochy has managed more regular season games. Baker, as of now, if he never manages another game, has an even 3,500 under his belt regular season games.
That is 15th all-time in baseball history.
Yeah.
So he is one of the all-time managers, and he has not won a World Series. So that's something that is off his resume, and he clearly thought that he would have a chance to do so in Washington. That's not going to happen. And so you can kind of see both sides of this. Obviously, he was incredibly successful during the regular season, but the Nationals do have a limited window. If Bryce Harper does leave after 2018, it might be a while before the Nationals again have the type of team that is capable of making this kind of run. And so you can see why they might have wanted to go in a different direction and get someone that can push them to a World Series, or at least win a playoff series.
Well, let me ask you this before we get into the meat of this segment, Dylan. Do you think that Bryce Harper has a sort of LeBron James kind of sway as far as picking the next manager of this Nationals team? By that I mean, of course, LeBron James is looked at partly as a player general manager for the Cleveland Cavaliers and gets to pick his head coach all the time. You know,
going back to the Miami Heat days, he has that kind of sway as a superstar in the NBA. And you'd think if the Nationals want to try to convince Bryce Harper to stay long-term in the district, maybe they'd give him at least some input there.
I can absolutely see where that idea comes from. I don't think we're going to be hearing anything about GM Bryce over the next few months or so. But whether or not he actually has an explicit say in the decision, obviously he's not as influential as LeBron because he's not the clear best player in the league, and a single baseball player is not as valuable as a single basketball player. However, we'd probably be naive to think that the Nationals are not keeping him in mind as they make the decision on who will be Baker's successor. It is an incredibly important season coming up for the Nationals franchise. Not only with this team they have as presently constructed, they want to keep that window open, but in keeping Harper and convincing him to stay past this season. So it's someone they really need, and it's a question of whether they can find someone that gives them a better chance to win a World Series than Baker did.
That's a very good point, and I think now we just have two main questions, and Nationals fans in general have two main questions. One, was the Nats' failure this season Dusty's fault? And two, who can the Nationals justifiably bring in and say, here, this manager is going to give us a better chance at a World Series than Dusty Baker was giving us? So where should we start there, Dylan? We talked about both sides of the opinion. Do you really think that any of this was Dusty's fault, or what percentage was Dusty's fault?
Well, it's hard to assign something like that, obviously. We are not a show that deals in hot takes of that nature, but it is something that we can kind of discuss as to what led to the Nationals' failure in the postseason this year. And part of it was they didn't hit in the postseason, so you obviously can't really blame that on Dusty. They got there. They won 97 games. The playoffs, there's a lot of chance in the playoffs over a short series in baseball. But on the other hand, Baker did make some questionable managerial decisions in the NLDS against the Cubs, took out starters early, had the whole debacle with Strasburg and the mold. It was not his finest hour as a manager, especially in Game 5.
Forgot we can't let hashtag mold go. I don't think that was ever solved, and it may never be now. So, I mean, Dylan Sin, of course, our resident Cubs fan here, and I'm going to try my best to not jab him for his Chicago roots as going forward, but Dylan watched every game of the series. Dylan, you also have some experience with Dusty Baker way back in our childhood days when Baker managed the Cubs for a few years.
Yeah, again, Dusty, he did make some questionable decisions in the series. He took pitchers out a little bit early in Game 5. The bullpen really struggled, and so you can make the case that Dusty deployed them incorrectly or deployed them in an order where it didn't give them the best chance to succeed. Obviously, that's all conjecture, and it's difficult to say which move adversely affected a series that was so close, but you can say that that is one of the few series where the team's talent level was so similar that every move a manager makes is definitely going to be under a microscope and has the chance to affect a game.
We saw the same thing kind of happening with Joe Girardi in New York during the wildcard game and during the ALDS before the Yankees advanced all the way to the ALCS and it even ended up with a 3-2 lead over Houston at one point. But coming from where I come from in New Jersey, the limited amount of time I spent in New Jersey this summer, you turn on ESPN New York radio, and everybody calling in had something to pick at about Girardi, where he was putting Judge in the lineup. Why'd he put him too low? Why'd he put him too high? He should be giving him a day. He's got to figure out the strikeout thing. Even more so than football, it's like the easiest thing to do to nitpick at a manager's decision.
Armchair managing is a huge thing in baseball because, especially in baseball, people understand the strategy behind the decisions even better than they do in basketball and football, which are much more complicated in terms of the rationale that goes into each decision. So it's a lot easier to sit there and armchair manage. And something that you mentioned with hitting Judge in the lineup, that's something else that I failed to mention earlier, is Dusty continued to bat Anthony Rendon, who was one of their best hitters this year. Hit him sixth, Jason Wirth hit second, and Rendon was clearly a better hitter this year, so that was something also that a lot of the district blogosphere was not happy about, that Baker continued to do that, especially in the playoffs.
So to wrap up this segment, Dylan, let's look at who the Nationals are interviewing, and let's do a little bit of that speculation we often stay away from. Just for a taste of this, we might next week be back on here to say, well, hey, the Nationals hired XYZ, but who have they brought in to interview, if anybody, yet? Or are they planning to interview anybody?
Well, one person, I'm going to talk about the Cubs first, as I will.
Oh, God.
one of the managerial candidates who they have not interviewed yet, but they have requested an interview, is Dave Martinez, who is the Cubs bench coach under Joe Maddon. He was with Joe Maddon in Tampa as well. He was the Tampa bench coach from 2008 to 2014.
Back when they were pretty good, too.
Exactly. And so when Maddon left to become the Cubs manager, Martinez made it clear that that he wanted a chance to be the manager. And so the Rays decided, they gave him a look. He wasn't one of the three finalists. And so he made it clear that he didn't want to be in Tampa Bay anymore. He came to the Cubs, and he clearly has managerial aspirations. He's known as kind of a rising star around the league, and is someone that the Nationals will likely bring in. He obviously has studied under Madden for almost a decade now, so it's someone that would certainly be a possibility. In addition to Martinez, another candidate that the Nationals have already talked about bringing in is Mike Maddux, the pitching coach, and that would be someone that they'd be promoting from within, obviously. He's been the pitching coach for the same 2 years that Baker was the manager, and the Nationals have been incredibly successful as a pitching staff in that time. They ranked second in starters ERA in 2016 and fourth in that metric this year. Obviously, that has something to do with the fact that they have Max Scherzer and Steven Strasburg and the rest of the starting pitchers in that rotation, so the talent level is incredibly high. But Maddux has been a very successful pitching coach. He has now been a pitching coach for 15 years after pitching for 15 years. So it's something, he has an incredible amount of experience. He's mentioned wanting to be a manager in the past, and he's passed over several jobs, actually.
I remember him being offered some in the past, but
he's taken his name out of consideration for several jobs in the past.
Not offered directly, then, in that case, then at least in conversation.
Right, and so it might be something where he might be looking for the ideal job. And a team that has won 95 games or more in the last 2 years, you're not really going to get much more of an ideal situation than that.
And he's in-house already. You don't have to request for an interview like they do with the Cubs. We'd like to, we'd like to interview Dave Martinez. So that's going to help. That's one thing. And it might actually be the most logical choice to promote from within. So there's not a ton of turnover.
Yeah, there'll be some more continuity, even though you're changing managers and kind of shaking it up. There's still a little bit of continuity from the teams that have been so successful in the last 2 years.
I want to offer one more suggestion that's a little more off the wall. What do you think about John Farrell?
I could see that. He was very successful with Boston. They won a World Series with him in 2013, so clearly he brings that championship experience that they really are really looking for.
Yeah, we're talking about who's going to give the Nationals a better chance of the World Series than Dusty Baker was going to give him. Farrell not only has one World Series under his belt, he did that in his first season with Boston. So if you're talking about a small window, you want to win next year, maybe recreate that magic. But Farrell, in his 7 years managing the Blue Jays and then the Red Sox, he's always had teams win at least 71 games, but usually in the 90s, especially with Boston, 90-win teams, and in terms of overall postseason record, 12-11 all-time managing in postseason games, which is a winning percentage of .522, a lot better than Dusty Baker's career of .418. A smaller sample size, but not by a whole lot, 23 games.
No, not at all.
I just want to put that out there. The Red Sox hired Alex Cora already to replace Farrell, and Farrell's out of a job. And a Jersey guy? That has nothing to do with Washington. It has something to do with me. I want to see Farrell have another shot, because I think the Red Sox, they did a lot with not a super talented team this year.
No, they
had. And if you give Farrell a chance to manage a better team, even if the National League might be a little more talented overall, it could happen.
You can definitely see where that would be someone that the Nationals would be interested in bringing in. And you're right, the Red Sox were not uber talented this year. They have some good young talent, but the rest of the roster is pretty mediocre, is probably a good word to describe it. And so bringing Farrell into some team that has an incredible amount of talent like the Nationals do, that could be a perfect storm for them, where they do recreate some of that magic from Farrell's first season in Boston in 2013, which would be the ideal situation for the Nationals next year.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see, Dylan. Let's return next segment to some sports that are in season. Baseball's still in season with the World Series. I'm sure you're all watching that. But as far as some Washington teams to look at coming up, we're going to have a lot to talk about. So stay tuned. Welcome back to War on Hot Takes with Dylan Sin. I'm Adam Zalanka, and we need to discuss the Washington Wizards. And we were hoping to be able to discuss a 4-0 Washington Wizards team, but after starting 3-0 and being the last Eastern Conference team that was undefeated, they, as part of a long West Coast trip to start the season here, in Los Angeles on Wednesday night, they fell in overtime to the Lakers, 102-99, and they're now 3-1. Every team in the Eastern Conference has at least one loss now. And before Wednesday, the Wizards were just the fourth team in NBA history to start the season 3-0 by winning each of their games by 5 points or fewer. This according to the Elias Sports Bureau, Dylan.
When they played the Lakers on Wednesday, it was a really weird game. They seemed to be in control of the game for most of the second half at least, and they were up by 10 points at one point during the middle of the fourth quarter. And then at that point, they just missed 7 consecutive shots. The Lakers came back and ended up going to overtime, as you said. And in overtime, again, they just couldn't get anything to fall. So the Lakers won. It was a really weird game. Lonzo Ball, the Lakers' young rookie, as I'm sure all of you know by now, had actually a pretty terrible game. He went 2-for-11 from the field, had just 6 points. So we're not going to talk about, by the way, Lonzo's father. He will not be mentioned on this show.
No more mentioning him now that we brought him up in the first place. We're not naming him, none of that.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Wizards were outscored 23-13 in that fourth quarter after having a 10-point lead, as we said. Bradley Beal led with 28 points, and John Wall had 18 points and 9 assists, but John Wall had a minus 14 for the day. Marcin Gortat, one of my favorites, the Polish hammer, like MG hammer for him too. He had 14 rebounds, obviously leading the Wizards in rebounds pretty easily. Otto Porter had 2 steals, which is kind of a slow night for him this year because Otto Porter actually leads the NBA through 8 days worth of games. Some teams have played 5, some teams have played 4. Otto Porter has more steals than anybody in the NBA. He has 13. Although he does not lead in steals per game, because he falls to Patrick Beverley of the Clippers by a fraction in that category, per 36 minutes, it is way different. It's just anomalous. It's not what you expect
anomalous,
from him.
Anomalous, good word.
Anomalous for his career. 2015 through 16, he had 1.7 steals per 36, 1.6 steals per 36 a season ago. Right now, he's averaging 3.4 steals every 36 minutes played.
And we should jump in there and say, by the way, 4 games into the season, everything right now is small sample size. We're going to keep harping on that for a while, but you can draw some conclusions. In the beginning of the season, you kind of see what adjustments people have made in the offseason, what they've really tried to focus on, and clearly, Otto Porter has tried to focus on being more aggressive on defense.
He's playing really well, and the advanced metrics bear this out too, Dylan, because his defensive rating, which estimates points allowed per 100 possessions, a contribution. This can be on the individual level or on a team level. He has career best so far, again, through 4 games, of 98, which is better than the average. Four games, smallsamplesize.com, Small Sample Size Incorporated. But it's going to be a small sample size for a while until it's not. We just want to always have our disclaimers.
But again, as we said, even with a small sample size, you can start to see patterns emerge early in the season. And one pattern that emerged in the Wizards' first 3 games was they have really improved this season at getting to the foul line. Through 3 games, the Wizards were averaging over 33 free throw attempts. Well, I'll say that 3 times fast. 33 free throw attempts per game, which ranked 3rd in the NBA. And the biggest driver of that was, of course, John Wall, who has made a living in his career getting to the free throw line. And this year, he had done it even more often than usual. In his first 3 games, he averaged 11 free throw attempts per game by himself, which led the NBA as the most in the NBA through the first 3 games of the season. But then Wednesday night against the Lakers, he got to the line just 4 times. He went 3-for-4 from the line. So that was obviously something that contributed to the Wizards falling in the fourth quarter and the Lakers coming back, because if you're not getting to the line, every possession is more difficult. You're not getting any of those free points. And if Wall's not getting to the line, their offense can kind of stagnate.
It doesn't pair well either with his 7-for-22 from the field and 1-for-5 from three-point arc. Now, I'm also worried about this bench still, Dylan. It's really acting pretty similar to last year, despite my projections that Jody Meeks and Tim Frazier would prove them a lot. Meeks had 11 off the bench last night, but no other bench player had more than 4. And that includes Mike Scott, who played 25 minutes and went an abysmal 2-for-10. He took twice as many shots as Meeks or anybody else who came off the bench and played almost twice as many minutes as anybody, and he had a pretty dismal game. Did grab 8 rebounds defensively, so that's good, but why is he taking all those shots?
It really is interesting why they kept him in there for 25 minutes, probably to give the starters a little extra rest. You don't want to play them an incredible amount of time, especially just in the fourth game of the season. But early in the season, you talked about the bench has struggled again, as it did last year, and clearly the coaching staff knows that, because the Wizards starters through the first 3 games this season averaged 33 minutes per game, the 5 starters did, which is
the most in the NBA.
So clearly the coaching staff knows that their bench is a little bit weaker compared to some of the other benches in the league, and they've kept their starters out there for more minutes, which might not seem like a big deal now, but when you get later in the season, might start to get a little bit tired, get a little fatigued late in the game because they played so many minutes early.
Yeah, and that's not something we'll really be able to tell for sure until it comes March and it drags toward the 60th game of the season, that sort of frame. They might not need to play Mike Scott as many minutes in the future,
right?
Because Markieff Morris might be back as soon as next week. Candace Buckner of the Washington Post reported that they are targeting November 3rd, which they happen to be playing a pretty important team, the Cleveland Cavaliers, here in the district for Morris's return, but he could be back as soon as they come back from this West Coast swing that they're on. Right now, so after starting the season, 2 home games against Philadelphia and Detroit, they went to Denver, won there by 5,
last night played the Lakers in LA. Side note, it's a podcast, you can't see it, but go open a new tab next to Twitter and next to us and look up the uniforms the Lakers wore. These throwbacks, they're supposed to be the Minneapolis, but it just says MNPL,
or was it MPLS?
MPLS.
Which I don't know how that stands for Minneapolis.
Bad parody of like an airport code, with three-letter airport codes. Powder blue, which is more like a Warriors uniform. Now, Friday night, that's who they play next, is
good
at Golden
segue.
State. I did it. I got my one good segue of the day. And then Sunday at Sacramento completes an early four-game road swing, West Coast swing, before their home Wednesday the 1st against Phoenix, and then Friday the 3rd, as we said, against Cleveland. We could be seeing Markieff Morris back for one of those games by then, hopefully, from his injury situation. But in the meantime, they've been playing, like we sort of started hinting at last week, not that we're sort of Nostradamuses about this, but Kelly Oubre's been starter at the 3, and they've had Otto Porter playing the stretch fork a role there. Underneath with Gortat. Not the biggest team when that's the case, but you know what? You don't need advanced metrics to say you're 3-1 through 4, and that's better than most teams in the league.
It's been a successful early season for the Wizards. They clearly have some of the same problems they did last year, but a couple of players, as you said, Otto Porter leading the league in steals, John Wall getting to the line, those are positive developments, and that's something that the Wizards definitely want to see going forward. And if we want to get off the Wizards for a second, but stay in the NBA, before we go and finish this segment off, I want to talk about a local Dematha kid, Victor Oladipo, really quick.
Dematha High School, right down the road from where we sit today.
Exactly, and so we figured we'd want to talk about him a little bit just because he has had an incredible early season run with the Indiana Pacers. He went to college at Indiana University. For those of you who don't know, I am an Indiana University alum.
There's always something. I thought we were going to get through this episode without a lot of Chicago talk, and here we are. Dylan's IU connections now. Jeez.
So Victor Oladipo was a year ahead of me at Indiana, so I watched him play. And it's interesting to me to see him playing much better with the Pacers. He's averaging 26 points a game through the Pacers' first five games, shooting 50% from the field and almost 45% from three-point land. So it has been an incredible early season run for Oladipo. And as a Dematha kid, that's good to see.
He's a guy, I think he comes back and has basketball camps here in Maryland at Dematha High School, his alma mater. Really good guy, obviously. Somebody people around here would be rooting for. Well, that's plenty of basketball talk now. It's football season to me, Dylan. I can't get into too much basketball until March or February, maybe, when the Super Bowl is over. So let's finish off this episode of War on Hot Takes when we come back and talk your local NFL teams.
That's right. Right. We'll be back with some Washington and Baltimore football talk when we come back.
Welcome back to War on Hot Takes. It's Adam Zalanka here with you with Dylan Sin, and we've got to talk about a couple football teams local to the NBA. As per usual, it's our weekly tradition, more so than any other sport. Let's start with Washington, Dylan, because they played most recently. They played on Monday night this week. They're the first team this year, actually, to play two Monday night games so far, and they've lost both, and maybe that shouldn't be a surprise because Kirk Cousins is now 0-6 on Monday Night Football, Dylan.
That's right. It's more than a trend now for Cousins. They are 0-6 on Monday night, although it wasn't all his fault last night. The Eagles have the best run defense in football, and it really showed last night. They were able to make Washington one-dimensional. Cousins ended up throwing the ball 40 times. He rolled up over 300 yards, and they put up 24 points, but it was something that when you are that one-dimensional, when the game gets tight and you need a big play, it's hard to surprise the opposing defense.
Yeah, Cousins had a pretty good game. Again, he had 3 touchdowns. Well, he had a good game. Carson Wentz had a better game and essentially out-dueled him when you look at quarterback versus quarterback. Cousins, he has the 5th highest total QBR through this 7 weeks of the NFL season. He's at 67.7 total QBR for the season. Much better than Joe Flacco, which we'll tell you a little more about later. But let's stick to this team, one team at a time. Washington, as we started to say last week, yeah, they weren't able to run on Philadelphia, or they perhaps didn't try too much because there were only 15 designed handoffs.
Right.
But also, as we said last week, if they were to lose this game, which then they did, they will have a 3-3 record with all three of those losses coming against two of the best teams in football. Kansas City, that previous Monday night loss, and now 2 losses to Philadelphia. Philadelphia has now swept them for the season series. Now, Philadelphia is 6-1 to Washington's 3-3, which means that's a 2.5 game difference already in the NFC East, and it's really more like a 3.5 game difference when you come down to it
because of the tiebreaker. Yes,
Philadelphia would win a tiebreaker if they finished with the same record as Washington.
that pretty much already, hate to say it, kind of puts Washington in a tough spot. I won't say they're completely out of the race, but they're 3.5 down in a season that's only got 9 more games.
The focus more for Washington this season is probably going to be on snagging one of those couple wild card spots there. And so looking at their schedule over the next 4 weeks, they're really entering a crucial stretch. The next 4 games coming up are against Dallas, Seattle, Minnesota, and New Orleans. Other than Dallas, those teams are all at least 4-2. Minnesota's 5-2. And Dallas might be the most important of those 4 games because they are 3-3. Washington and Dallas are tied for second place in the NFC East. These two teams play each other twice over the next 6 weeks. And so if Washington loses both of those games, that might be really it for their playoff chances. So they have to at least split, and so this coming week will be a huge test. We've talked already, Adam said it, all 3 of their losses have come against a couple of the best teams in the league. Dallas seems to be a little bit more of their speed, I would say.
That's a good way to put it. A little more vulnerable.
Exactly, and so it's something that we'll kind of see where Washington stands in the NFC East this week.
Yeah, and when we do see, we got to follow along with the Washington tight ends, who are really pacing the Washington receivers. Let's start just with the box score from Monday night. Vernon Davis and Jordan Reed were your 2 leading receivers, and third tight end Niles Paul had a catch for 32 yards that was good enough to make him their 4th leading receiver yardage-wise. Between Reed, Davis, and Paul, they had 15 targets among them, and there were only 18 to receivers between your Jamison Crowders and your Terrell Pryors, your Josh Dotson. Dotson led the receivers, 3 catches for 39. And to be fair to Jordan Reed, who we mentioned earlier in the season, hadn't been off to a good start. He came alive and scored a pair of touchdowns, his first 2 of the season in this game. I mean, we focus mostly on the offense. You could probably say something about this defense that just gave up 34 to Philadelphia. But honestly, Philadelphia really looks like the real deal, a complete team this year, Dylan. And to your point earlier, honestly, we don't know just how good this Washington team could be, or conversely, how poor it could be, depending on how they fare against teams like Dallas, Minnesota, Seattle, New Orleans.
Right, and that's something, again, we're going to see in the next few weeks. We're really going to know a lot more about this team. And one thing that we should point out is that their point differential so far this season is -6. So they're right around even in terms of point differential. So you would expect them to be right about where they are at 3-3. They haven't been getting lucky. They haven't been getting unlucky. They are, at this point, a .500 team. And whether that continues or whether they prove that they can play with some better competition is what we'll see here in the next few weeks.
Dylan, did you like that tease I did a little earlier about Joe Flacco?
I did like that tease.
Well, Kirk Cousins has the 5th best QBR in the league right now, 67.7. Joe Flacco, give the audience like a minute, not even a minute, just a second to think just off the top of their head. Between 1st and 32nd, where's Joe Flacco total QBR? Jeopardy music, we don't have a license for that in here. Joe Flacco is 30th in the league in total QBR this season with a 30.0. And again, QBR, quarterback rating, it's an advanced stat ESPN designed over a decade ago at this point, I think, that encapsulates a lot more than just passing, but everything a quarterback does or can do, including running and including down situation and a lot of things like that. Not a perfect metric. There are even more advanced ones that we'll tell you about, but they will bear the same thing out. Flacco, 30th out of 32. The 2 quarterbacks who have worse QBRs this year than Joe Flacco are Mike Glennon of Chicago. DeShone Kizer, the rookie for Cleveland, is last. But Glennon and Kizer,
what do they have in common, Adam?
They both lost their jobs at some point.
That's right. They both lost their jobs.
Glennon got benched pretty early. Kizer is in a weird situation in Cleveland where they're sort of deciding as the weeks go by which terrible quarterback to roll out onto the field to keep the Browns losing. And 29th, Brian Hoyer, San Francisco, also lost the job because C.J. Beathard is suddenly their new starter for the 49ers. Joe Flacco is not losing his job. Why is that? Because the Vikings, we didn't mention this before, just beat Baltimore this weekend and sent them down to 3-4. And this Ravens team has a lot of splaining to do.
The numbers on Flacco this week specifically are pretty ugly. He went 39 attempts, 186 yards for a 4.7 yard per attempt average, which is absolutely anemic. His quarterback rating, which we just talked about, he ranks 30th in the league. It was 15.2 this week, so even worse than his season average. That's the 4th time this season he's been under 20 for a quarterback rating. As we get into more advanced metrics, if you go to Football Outsiders, which is one of the leading football advanced metrics websites, they have the stat, which we've talked about on this show in the past, called DVOA, which is basically efficiency. It stands for defense adjusted value over average, and it's what percentage efficiency they give you above average.
And to point out, the last time we brought it up, We were talking about teams, I believe. We're talking about where Washington was, I think, at the time, like fourth in offensive DVOA. But you can do it for a full team or an offense or a defense or an individual player. Today, we're going to be talking about individual players like Joe Flacco.
Right. And so right now, Football Outsiders has Joe Flacco ranked 30th in quarterback DVOA. He is negative 29.3%. That means he's 29.3% below average in terms of efficiency. And again, just like with QBR, the only quarterbacks below him are Glennon and Kaiser, who have lost their jobs.
Yeah.
So in terms of even more advanced stats than what you see in normal box scores, Flacco is struggling there too. For all intents and purposes, he has been one of the worst quarterbacks in the league this year.
Yeah, and as stat-oriented and data-driven as we are on this podcast, you know our tagline, there's also the eye test. And to go in a radio shock jock mode for just a second, he's not really passing the eye test right now. He throws picks like crazy. Now, the Vikings are a good defense. Don't underestimate the Vikings defense. But there comes a point where you start to wonder, what's left in the tank for this guy? Has he shown us the best he's going
to
ever be?
It's a long way up from where he is now to where he was at his peak. And one thing that really held him back this season is his performance on long passes. Flacco has one of the strongest arms in the league. That's something that you'd expect him to excel at. But this year, he's just 10 for 33 for 241 yards and 5 interceptions on passes that travel 16 yards or more down the field. So when he's had success, it's been on shorter passes, on dump-offs, which are less about the quarterback and more about his receivers making plays after the catch.
Let's emphasize this one because I think it's probably the most fascinating stat we've had today on any segment. And this comes from NumberFire. We saw this a little while ago, so we want to make sure we give that guy some credit, Brandon Gadula. We're talking about throws of 16 yards or more down the field. So not short or medium length passes, but on long passes specifically. 10 for 33 on the season and 5 picks versus 2 touchdowns.
Something that he's had success with in the past. He's been a good passer down the field.
Yeah.
And this year, it just the exact opposite is true. And so you wonder where his strength truly lies at this point. Obviously, they're probably not going to bench him anytime soon. They're 3-4. They're probably not Super Bowl contenders
this year.
There are a
lot of 3-4 teams.
They're exactly. And so maybe they make a run later in the season, but right now there's a lot to figure out at quarterback position for the Ravens.
If you're listening to this Thursday when this podcast comes out, you know that the Ravens are back in action Thursday against the Miami Dolphins on some Thursday night football, hosting them there in Baltimore. And I think we better wrap this segment up with some players to watch, starting with the Ravens. So you're listening to this, it's either that game is already over and you missed out, or you're hearing it right when we drop this on Thursday, and it's got a shelf life of about 6 hours, unfortunately. But such is the curse of Thursday night football, the NFL's insistence on playing every day of the week. So, Dylan, for the Ravens player to watch for this week, I'm going to go with an old standby we haven't talked too much about this season, Terrell Suggs. One of the oldest players in football at this point at 35 years old, but still very consistent, very useful in the Ravens' defensive efforts. He had the team's second highest Pro Football Focus grade last week against the Vikings with an 83.4. Only Brandon Carr did better. We just talked about him a little bit ago. He is the 17th overall edge rusher in the NFL this year in terms of Pro Football Focus's grading system with an 84 overall. So
that
right
is
about
incredible after at 35 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Ravens are going to need it. I can speak from personal experience because the Dolphins, who Ravens play tonight, Thursday night, just played my Jets.
Your Jets.
You want to shout it? Well, I think the Ravens actually owe me personally thank you because we broke Jay Cutler's ribs in that game, and Matt Moore will be the starting quarterback for the Miami Dolphins Thursday night and for a little while going forward as Cutler heals up. Welcome back to the NFL, Jay. Sorry. It was a clean hit. It was a clean hit, so it happens. It's football. Matt Moore's not a great quarterback, but he's a good number two quarterback. He's good that you can bring him out in a pinch. You got to rush the quarterback, and you got to contain Jay Ajayi. And Terrell Suggs can help in both facets. Ajayi not having a super season, only averaging 3.5 yards per carry. The Jets shut him down twice this season, once in a win, once in a loss. But I just want to finish by saying, remember last year, the Dolphins strung together a 6-game winning streak in the second half of the season. It was the Baltimore Ravens that shut them down. Huge faction, 38-6. And you know how many tackles Terrell Suggs had in that game?
How many?
Zero.
Zero.
So maybe they don't actually need Suggs after all, and I just defeated my entire point. He had 2 quarterback hits, yet he had no actual tackles in that interesting game. Everything's interesting.
You know what? Watch Terrell Suggs anyway, because he's a future Hall of Famer. He's always fun to watch. So regardless whether he has tackles or not.
And one more thing. He's actually listed as questionable for the Thursday night game with a knee injury. He might not even play in the first place. If he does, watch him, to Dylan's point. Watch him anyway. If he's on the sideline, watch him. So I might have just defeated my whole point a second time. But listen, he's Terrell Suggs. He needed a mention on the War on Hot Takes podcast during its lifespan.
Absolutely.
Now, Dylan, as far as Washington goes, they were the focus of our Twitter poll this week. Who won?
Now, winner this week for our Twitter poll was tight end Jordan Reed, who has underachieved this season, I think would be fair to say. But he had his best game of the year last week against the Eagles, had 8 catches for 64 yards and 2 touchdowns, both coming late in the game as Washington was trying to come back. And one of those touchdowns was actually a pretty incredible play. He caught a ball on a slant, broke a tackle, and dove into the end zone. So the athleticism has always been his greatest strength. He seems to be getting some of that back. And I say getting some of that back because he clearly hasn't been 100% for most of the season. He missed all of training camp with a toe injury, and he kind of said as much about not being 100% after the game. He said, "I think it was more of me getting more comfortable on the field. I missed the whole offseason, so just getting comfortable out there. My toe is getting a little bit better, and I got my burst back a little bit." So all of that factors in. And I think what you can take from that quote is that he hasn't been 100%. He knows he hasn't been 100%, and he probably still isn't. And yet he just put up his best game of the season. So he's getting closer, and I think every week from now on would be a good week to watch Jordan Reed, because he still remains one of the most talented tight ends in the league. And he wasn't going to let Vernon Davis be the number one tight end on the team for the entire season. So he is the tight end to watch this week.
And there you go. They'll be hosting the Dallas Cowboys on Sunday, 4:25 p.m. And we'll be watching. And we hope you will be joining us again next week on War on Hot Takes. For Dylan Sin, I'm Adam Zlanka. Thanks again for joining us.